Tomahawk missiles, the latest wonder weapon, which is surely going to change the terms of the war on the ground in Ukraine in Kiev's favor, and is going to finally send Russia reeling into defeat, or bring them to the table and abject poverty and make them have a deal that's something that's going to be approved by Kiev and Volodymyr Zelensky. At least that seems to be the idea that some people have. That, as you certainly guess from my mocking tone, is very far from actual reality. And as we turned out, there's some news that's just actually breaking here recently that it may not even be on the table. It might not never have been on the table. But in terms of this and lots of other things that have to very much that are on the table and have to do with where this war is going, we have back with us today Jennifer Cavanaugh, senior fellow and director of military analysis at Defense Priorities, where I am also on staff, and always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, I know you've been kind of globetrotting all over the place, and you got some more trotting coming up here, so we're grateful that we got you in here today. But let's just jump right on this issue here, because I guess it was on Sunday, at least the way things have unfolded, that Vice President J.D. Vance admitted on television that Zelensky had actually requested Tomahawks, that he said, well, the president's considering doing that, but we'll see how it's going to work out. Yesterday in Europe, Zelensky himself, I think it was in Copenhagen, he actually, in reference to a question, kind of coyly implied that, yeah, we might be getting that pretty soon. He said, we'll just wait and see. But then, as it turns out, I think you just told us a minute ago that information out today seems to say that they're off the table. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think the latest reporting is that the missiles are no longer being considered for sending to Ukraine. The reason given is that the stockpiles that are currently available, as well as planned production, is all allocated towards U.S. forces. Tomahawk missiles are incredibly important for the U.S. military. It's one of the longest range, most precise systems, one of the most powerful weapons it has in its arsenal. It can be fired by submarine, by guided missile destroyer, and there's also a ground launcher. They played a big role in the Middle East, in the campaign against the Houthis. They were also used in the strike on Iran. And in any type of contingency in Asia, they would play an extremely important role. So these are very precious and very scarce missiles. Production rates are typically quite low per year. So, that's one factor that I think is keeping them off the table.
And by the way, do you know what even publicly reported, what is the production rate per year?
You know, it's a little bit hard to tell because the military typically buys only a couple hundred per year. I think that's under the amount that they can totally produce, though. But production rates total at max production is under 500 a year. And the military typically procures something on the order of, 250 across the services per year.
Right. That's not something you want to get sustained for a long time. Now, as it turns out, you have just recently published something on this very issue, which I found very interesting and illuminating. Because one of the things you say, Gary, if you can toss that full screen of it up there, that would be cool. You said that Russia likely laughing off Trump's open door, even besides whether it's now being publicly said that it's unlikely. You said he probably isn't that worried about it. And one of the reasons is because you said Tomahawk missiles can be fired three ways: from a guided missile destroyer, from Ohio, Virginia, and LA class submarines, and using the new ground-based Typhoon system, which was developed by the Army. Ukraine does not have any of these capabilities. And then you mentioned there also at the end that the production rate is low and the number are scarce. Now, if we were to do that, I mean, it would seem, correct me if I'm wrong, but the only way that even happens is if we something close to get personally directly involved in the war to allow them. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, providing advanced missiles of any kind, whether it's Tomahawk or JASSM or any of the other missiles that are on the table, would involve the U.S. getting more entangled in the war, because it would rely on U.S. intelligence and U.S. targeting assistance. So no matter what type of missile you're talking about, the United States would be getting more involved if any type of longer range missile were provided. With the Tomahawks, Ukraine does not have a delivery system. So unless it's the United States launching it physically from U.S. submarines or physically from U.S., destroyers, which would be, I think, impossible. I don't think there are any destroyers right now in the Black Sea. Or getting one of these Typhoon systems into Ukraine, which would involve, these systems are huge. If you've seen the picture, it's like the size of like five semi-trucks. They're going to drive across the border to Poland, on their way to somewhere in Ukraine to fire these missiles. I mean, that's an easy target for you know, for Russian airstrikes. So to me, the fact that there's no launch vehicle, like no launch system, is the key reason why the Tomahawks don't make sense. Why give them Tomahawks? They can't launch. They can't throw them across the border. So, you know, to me, this was never a realistic thing. To me, you know, number one, this was, you know, possibly a way of trying to make Russia nervous, though Russia knows all this information. All the information I just shared is publicly available information that Russia knows. Or, you know, Ukraine is asking for Tomahawks and hoping that it will get JASMs or some other type of not, you know, 2,500 kilometers, but something with 500 kilometer range instead.
And Gary, do we still have that, that soundbite from Putin talking about the possibility for these Tomahawks? Do we still have that loaded up?
No, I'll have to grab it.
Wait, okay. If you could, yeah, because I want to put that from the Valdai conference the other day. He made a comment on that, and I want to get your view on that on the backside of it. But just even generally, what is in America's interest here to even be entertaining this possibility?
I mean, it's really not. You and I have discussed this before. You know, U.S. interests really are to get uninvolved as quickly as possible. And that would mean stopping aid and stopping intelligence sharing and letting Ukraine and Russia, you know, fight until they're ready to negotiate. You know, Trump hasn't been willing to do that, I think partly because he's concerned about being blamed for losing Ukraine, just like Biden was blamed for the, you know, catastrophic way in which he withdrew from Afghanistan. Even though the withdrawal was the right decision, it was messy, and he took a political hit. And I think Trump does not want to take that. So if the United States is going to stay involved, you know, given that Trump seems to be willing to do that, you know, the focus here should be on wrapping up this conflict as quickly as possible. So providing Ukraine enough weapons to prevent additional territorial losses without having any escalation, without increasing U.S. involvement, and pushing hard, doubling down on diplomacy, which we have not seen. You know, since the Alaska summit, diplomacy is back to being pretty much stalled.
Yeah, and so I think we have it up ready to go now. Here's what Vladimir Putin said yesterday in terms of the possible escalation of the conflict.
Will this pose damage to our relations? Where we see light at the end of the tunnel, of course. Using Tomahawks without direct involvement of the U.S. officers is impossible, which means a brand new stage of escalation, even between Russia and the U.S.
So, I mean, even the concept of using these and the possibility of escalation, which it nearly would have to, because I just can't see Russia saying, okay, we suck down your ATACMs and your HIMARS and your Storm Shadows and, you know, and the like. But some of these, they said, well, you know, they couldn't be fired without some help from the Germans, from the British, from the United States, et cetera. But I just can't see them taking something like this, which can almost only be fired, as you say, from American military vessels and personnel, and then do nothing. Do you think that that's actually a risk or a possibility that Russia may, in a sense, not to escalate? Might they suck down something like this without doing anything?
I mean, no, I don't think so. I mean, even though I think that Putin knows that this is not a real threat, he benefits from being able to hype it up and to indicate that this is a new stage of involvement, that this would mean more long-range missiles, means a new level of U.S. engagement, means more direct war between the United States and Russia, because it gives him a reason and a rationale for increasing his own campaign against Ukraine. Now, obviously, his campaign so far has been quite brutal and has used significant, you know, long-range missiles and drones on Ukraine's infrastructure. But there's still more that he could use. Like, Russia is not maxed out. It has other capabilities it could use to impose even worse costs on Ukraine. And we should remember that when the ATACMs were first used back, you know, at last fall, that was when we first saw this new, you know, hypersonic missile that Russia used. The Oreshnik. That's when they first used it. Was after that. And that's when they first started ramping up the drone and missile attacks again at night. So we have seen him respond this way in the past. So there's very little chance in my mind that United States sends Ukraine long-range missiles, whether they're Tomahawks or some other kind of missile, and Putin just shrugs and keeps going the way he has been.
Well, if the Tomahawk missile probably isn't going to happen, that's not the only thing being discussed in the Western world about new things to bring into this war that could certainly bring an end to it, or that could force Russia into compulsion. And that is, to me, a really strange one that you've also covered from General David Petraeus, in that he says this new submarine drone could actually have a big effect there as well. Gary, if you can bring that full screen up there. This one, it was just kind of odd to me, and I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about it. Petraeus, Ukraine plan is a blueprint for failure, you write. But then he says these submarine type drones, is that's what can make it. In fact, Gary, I don't know if I sent you the full screen. There was a picture of the article she's referring to. Did I send you that one there? Can you pull that up if we did? Don't have it. Okay. Well, then that's on me for not sending it. But tell us what a bit Petraeus was actually trying to do here.
Well, Petraeus is putting forward like a 3-point plan for, you know, what Ukraine needs to do to be victorious. And I mean, the first red flag here is that's coming from David Petraeus, whose biggest accomplishment was the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't have any idea why we're still listening to him, to be honest. But, you know, he has this plan, a 3-point plan. First part is security guarantees. Second part is economic sanctions. You know, we've talked about those a lot. And the third piece is basically more and different types of drones. So he talks about having bigger numbers of drones. He talks about long-range strike drones. And then he has this whole piece about underwater robotic submarines that he thinks can impose additional costs on Russia's Black Sea Fleet, and that will be sort of a piece of, you know, really driving Russia back. And to me, you know, the more drones piece is not realistic in terms of a way to end the war. Drones alone aren't going to win the war. And in any case, Russia has now surpassed Ukraine, both in terms of quantities of drones produced and technological sophistication of drones produced. So now really the upper hand in the drone world is on Russia's side. More long-range strike drones, you know, we've talked about the limits of any type of long-range strike campaign. Russia is much bigger than Ukraine. It has the geographic space to just keep moving its critical assets out of Ukraine's range. And in any case, these types of long-range strikes, as Putin himself has said, don't change the military balance on the battlefield, and they don't change his calculus. As far as the undersea piece, I mean, Ukraine has been quite successful in its maritime campaign of using drones to impose costs on the Black Sea Fleet. They've driven the Black Sea Fleet away from Ukrainian coasts to Russian coastal ports. And that's a big deal because it's meant that Russia can't use the maritime domain to fire additional missiles into Ukraine's territory. It's also allowed Ukraine to reopen its grain trade. So getting some of that commercial traffic restarted has been important for its economy. But the maritime domain is really peripheral to what's happening on the ground where the war will actually be decided. So wasting a lot of time focusing on imposing additional costs on the Black Sea Fleet is sort of a waste. It's not
right. And in fact, that's what the first thing that occurred to me when I saw that headline that he wrote, because I thought, wait, what? I mean, as you just said, the Black Sea Fleet is already pretty much sidelined. So it's a marginal effect. Apparently, periodically they'll sally forth and fire off some missiles and run back to their other bases here. But that's not having anything to do with the fighting on the ground. And I was wondering, what even in his argument is that doing some of these undersea things can have any impact whatsoever on the line of contact?
He doesn't explain it. I mean, his only explanation is that this will impose costs on Russia. Well, true. It will impose costs. It'll be embarrassing. But so what? It's not going to actually affect the Eastern Front, which is where the war is being decided. If anything, it's a distraction for Ukraine to waste its resources on this maritime domain. As long as it can protect its coastline and keep its ports open, that's really all it needs. It doesn't need to do more. So I think, you know, there's throughout the war, there's been this idea that like if any costs we impose help us get closer to an end to the war. That's not true. A lot of costs that you impose are just kind of annoying and not all that meaningful for how the war progresses or turns out in the end.
Well, I know one of the other things I want to look at, that's, I said you've actually published three pieces here in the last few days because you're just such a prolific writer everywhere from the New York Times or in this case into Foreign Policy. I think this one's actually one of the most potentially consequential outside of whatever's happening on the front lines here. At some point, that war is going to end, and we're going to have to take a look at much bigger issues for our national security and especially going forward, and that is on the transatlantic relationship. And you wrote this piece in Foreign Affairs, and again, this is probably the creme de la creme for anybody to get published, which I've never been published in. I've been trying for many years, by the way. I'll just point that out. So I'm subordinate to you in that. But you wrote that the fatal flaw in the transatlantic alliance, Trump must do much more to rebalance America's relationship with Europe. A number of things that you say here, but one of the key ones is that you said that the United States has a burden, and NATO is out of the U.S. burden is out of proportion to what we are getting in terms of U.S. interests from our involvement in NATO. And you cite in there that we're one out of 32 countries, but we provide 16% of the cost. And then also we're suffering from some unfair trade barriers from Ukraine. Could you kind of explain why you say that the foundation is out of balance?
Yeah, well, I mean, the United States has long been the main security provider in Europe and the main security provider for all NATO countries, both in terms of the amount of cost that it bears, as well as military planning. Most of those forces are U.S. forces that would be involved in any sort of conflict. The number of U.S. forces based forward in Europe has ranged from a high of, you know, several hundred thousand during the Cold War, and now we still have 100,000 forces in Europe. But if you look sort of at U.S. interests, I mean, the U.S. has an interest in making sure that Europe isn't in Russia's sphere of influence, but we're so far from a world in which that is possible. Europe is a strong, wealthy, technologically advanced continent. These countries can afford to spend on their own defense. Even if they spent nothing on their defense, they actually have significant amounts of military capabilities. They're not well organized. They may not be exactly the right ones, but they're not this sort of like weak, powerless, mass of countries that they sometimes make themselves out to be. So, you know, the United States does not need a large military footprint forward to secure its interests. It needs maybe a small military footprint forward, and Europe can take on the bulk of that responsibility. So, you know, right now, the amount of effort and energy the United States spends militarily in Europe is way out of proportion to the interests that it has there.
And then let's look at that really important question, is American interest there? Because I think that part of the mental issue for the United States is that from 1949, we've been the absolute linchpin to keep the Western world safe. And especially in the beginning of NATO, we were indispensable because of all the losses that the entire Western Europe had suffered during the World War II. But this isn't 1949 anymore. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how things have shifted. We'll just keep it, say, in the last two decades, and why that argues that we should do less.
The United States' interests in Europe are significant, right? The United States has an economic stake in Europe. It trades a lot with Europe. It has an interest in having Europe be secure. But Russia has proven itself, you know, in the war in Ukraine to be quite weak. It has not been able to overpower Ukraine, a military that had 200,000 people in 2022 and was not well-trained or armed for a major power conflict. So just looking at sort of the threat that Europe faces, it's quite small. The chances that Russia invades a NATO country, in my view, are infinitesimal. Why would they do that? That would be suicidal. The idea that Russia is going to be marching on Berlin in a couple of years, which is what some Europeans believe, is preposterous.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just not necessary to have the costs that we bear, the costs of having such a large military footprint forward are just not worth it. We could secure our economic interests with, you know, almost no forces, maybe a small presence. And I'm not advocating here that we turn Europe into an enemy. And I would like to see, what we recommend in the article is a shift from a relationship that's based on military power to one that's based on economic and technological cooperation. Now, there would have to be changes there too, because right now, the way that the EU does its regulations does have implications for US companies, especially big tech, some small business, agriculture. So there would have to be some renegotiation there. There would, on the US side too, the United States has very high restrictions on technology and information sharing, and those would have to be lessened to have a more cooperative relationship with Europe. But like that, to me, that future is the one we want. And in fact, if you look back at the history of the founding of NATO and the founding of the transatlantic relationship at the end of World War II, like it was originally intended to be an economic relationship, not a military one. And even people like George Kennan, who we think of as like the father of containment and the, you know, architect of the Cold War, he was skeptical of a long-term U.S. military commitment in Europe. And yet we went right ahead with it. So, you know, not only doesn't make sense now to draw down, but it made sense back in the 50s to draw down. So really, we need to start rethinking this. And I'm not advocating here retrenching from Europe so we can pivot to Asia.
I'm going to get to that point in a minute because that's something you made in there. But let's take a look at some of the things that have happened recently, which would seem to imply that we are getting back into a rebalancing, but you said aren't quite what they look like. And one of the key things is that Trump has been highlighting that, yes, well, I finally got everybody in NATO not just to pay 2%, but 5%. So now then they're paying their fair share. What say you?
Well, I say that doesn't really help the United States. Having Europe pay more does not guarantee U.S. retrenchment. It maybe if they stick to that 5% commitment, if they actually meet it, and that's far from guaranteed. They made a 2% commitment like 20 years ago, and they made it now. Some of them are finally getting there. There's no guarantee. Today's leaders can't bind the hands of future leaders. So we don't know if they're going to make the 5%. But even if they did, like, that doesn't guarantee that the U.S. will draw down. Right now, we still have a U.S. leadership of NATO, a U.S. SACEUR, U.S. Leadership positions in other areas as well. So European military dependence is still institutionalized. And I was just in Europe for 2 weeks. And one thing I came away with is that, yeah, they're doing stuff. Yeah, they're rearming and they're trying to build up their militaries. But they do not have a clear strategic picture of what they're building towards, of what the threat is they're building towards. So instead of building something that's coherent without the United States, they're just building more capabilities that plug into a U.S. umbrella. And that, for me, is not the goal. The goal here is to have a European defense that's independent so the U.S. can pull back, not to have more European spending under a U.S. security umbrella.
Well, and you have the European leaders. I mean, you just came from there, so maybe you have some more insight here. But in just the last few days, we've had Chancellor Merz from Germany say that we're no longer in a state of peace with Russia. We're not war yet, but we're at peace. But then you had Donald Tusk yesterday at a conference there in Europe, and he said we kind of are at war with Russia, and we need to be paying attention to that. What do you make of those things?
I mean, I still find that helpful. It seems to me that Russia's pretty much done talking to Europe and Europe is pretty much done talking to Russia. And that's not a good situation to be in. That leads to a high risk of escalation and miscalculation that leads to war. You know, I don't think we should call drone incursions and cyber attacks war. That's not war. You know, that's harassment and that's competition. And it's not something that it's not desirable, but it's not war. We should be clear about that. And the idea that we're kind of on the precipice of war is not real in my view. You know, there's this idea in the European side that a Russian invasion of NATO countries is inevitable. It's coming. And I just do not share that perception. Russia does not have the capabilities to do that or the intent to do that. In fact, the fact that we've seen like almost 4 years of war before we saw any real drone incursions across the NATO border, to me, is what's surprising. Not that they happened, but that it took this long for it to happen. And that suggests to me that Putin has been very careful not to cross into NATO territory. So to me, the European threat perception is just totally out of balance.
And that's if we're supposed to be the leader of NATO, then that's not good for us, because I don't want anything that's going to even accidentally get us drawn into a war that we have absolutely no business fighting. How do you see it?
I mean, I agree 100%. I see a high risk of a Europe-Russia confrontation that drags the U.S. in, you know, via NATO. And I don't see a high chance of a U.S.-Russia confrontation, you know, in any other way, except if it's through European-Russia escalation. And so that to me is very concerning, because even if we recognize that a war with Russia is not in U.S. interest, even if we recognize that provocations by the Baltic states or other countries on the eastern flank like do not represent U.S. interests, if a war starts, it will be extremely politically difficult for a president, even for President Trump, to say, nope, not our fight. We're going to sit this one out.
Well, then it would almost seem to be reasonable, and tell me if you agree or disagree, to say we should do more disengagement, because I think that if Europe thinks that we're like, you know, locked hand in glove kind of thing, hand in hand, that if they do get sucked into a war, we're right there with them. But if we signal that, no, we're not like that, we might be your over the shoulder, but we're not going to be like the lead in front of you anymore. That might make them a little bit less willing to have these provocative statements. How do you think?
I mean, absolutely. I think the United States should be playing a restraining role. I think we should be reminding NATO allies the actual literal text of Article 5, which does not say if you provoke a war with Russia or if you're attacked, we automatically will send military forces. It says, you know, if there is an aggression on one member state, the other member states will consult and take action as they deem necessary. That might mean military forces, but it might mean a statement. It might mean military assistance. It might not mean the same types of commitments that frontline states are expecting. And we saw that a little bit with Trump's response to the Polish drone incursion, which was sort of a shrug, you know? And I do think that sent a message that, you know, we're still part of NATO, but we're going to be discerning about the types of things that we respond to.
And let's just ask a question here. You said that that part of this thing was part of the problem was it not just the military aspect, but also the economic aspect was not in balance. What would you recommend to fix that imbalance?
Well, I think that the trade agreement that President Trump is working on with the EU is in the right direction, but it can't be a one-off. It has to be sort of a fundamental restructuring. And right now we don't actually have a final agreement. It's still sort of a framework or a promise. So I think there needs to be a lot more like meat on the bones there is what I'd like to see.
And one of the other things that you said was, I guess, to put some, speaking of meat on the bones, taking meat off the bones, you suggest one possibility for distancing ourselves and requiring the Europeans to take more of their own responsibility would be to withdraw from Germany, Poland, and Romania, American forces. Did I read that correctly? And if so, how would you see that happening? Like next Tuesday or over a 5-year period? How would that happen?
I think it could happen over the course of the Trump administration. I think drawing down three combat brigades from Europe, ground combat brigades from Europe over three or four years is reasonable. You could do one a year. I mean, I think the reason that we point to that, and it's similar to the recommendation that Dan Caldwell and I made in our posture review, is because those ground forces are really the core of the U.S. commitment. Yes, we have air forces. Yes, we have naval forces. But it's really the ground forces that are the core of the commitment. So getting those out would send a pretty strong signal to Europeans that things were changing and that they could choose to step up or not, but the U.S. was leaving no matter what.
And what do you say to those critics that say, yeah, it'll send a signal, all right? It'll send a signal to Moscow to roll to Paris because they'll see that you don't mean anything, and then they'll just take that as a signal of weakness. How do you say that?
I mean, it's not going to happen, right? I mean, Putin doesn't have the military capabilities right now. Certainly, they're tied up in Ukraine to do it. Even a rebuilt Russian military, I'm not sure they have. I'm sure they do not have the capabilities to roll to Paris. They might have the capabilities to take territory from the Baltics, but that's really up to Europe to build up its own capabilities, which that they should have been doing all along.
And what do you say about the possibility that that this is not only is it not 1938 or not 1949, but it's also not 1938? Like this, there is not the possibility of having a situation to where you abandon Europe again. So the claim is, and just like when we gave up Czechoslovakia, if you were to give up this and the United States were to withdraw its forces, then that would embolden Putin to go south. And so, but one of the categorical differences between 1938 and today is the presence of nuclear weapons on both sides of the line, neither of which had it on the other time, and maybe made adventurism at least something to consider. How do you see the presence of nuclear weapons on both sides to even address the possibility, even if they had it later, that the Russians would then roll into a conventional war against Europe?
I mean, I think nuclear weapons are an important restraining factor on both sides. I mean, I do think that they create, I don't necessarily think they influence conventional calculations. Like, I think the two aren't necessarily intertwined. I think you could have, I think we've seen in Ukraine, you can have a conventional war without nuclear weapons, even if there are nuclear weapons sort of in the background on both sides. But I do think that the risk of some kind of tactical nuclear use rises if you had some sort of direct conflict between the United States and Russia or, you know, the United States and China. I think most likely, though, it would not be sort of like that it escalates immediately to that. It would have to be some sort of red line is crossed, right? Like one side feels that the threat has become existential, and that's when nuclear weapons are used. But you never want to get there, right? And given the proliferation of conventional missiles, though, that would throw a wrench into the planning a little bit, because if you think that if you think that your adversary has a conventional missile that can take out your leadership targets or that can hit Moscow or that can hit Berlin, then you might escalate to the use of nuclear weapons more quickly because of the uncertainty of the capabilities and reach of those missiles.
And what do you say to those critics that say, well, you can't trust Russia not to do this if you withdraw because they are this aggressive. In fact, it was just said just a couple of days ago by many of the European leaders that I think it was either Kaya Kallas or Ursula von der Leyen just said, no, you cannot trust Russia because they are an expansionist power. They've proven it over many decades, and they would just roll into. Do you see that as a legitimate threat, that Russia is just an expansionist power that's just waiting for the opportunity to go west?
Not really. I think Ukraine is a specific situation. I think that kind of argument discounts the fact that Russia has drawn clear red lines around Ukraine, around Georgia. It's made clear that these are, it sees these states as within its sphere of influence, and it will respond severely to anything that encroaches on that. They haven't responded the same way to things like Finland and Sweden joining NATO or the Baltic states, right? Like, these are in a different category. I think it's simplistic to kind of cast every territorial acquisition as the same. It suggests that, you know, Russia is only this aggressive expansionist power. It doesn't see sort of the nuances and differences. And I think that's not right. I think we could just look at the United States. United States has been like incredibly domineering in the Western Hemisphere in ways that it hasn't been elsewhere, where it doesn't see its interests as quite as severely threatened. Russia is the same.
And what would you recommend to Europe if they were worried about a revanchist Russia or an aggressive Russia if we were to withdraw? What should they do? And you can pick individual countries or just the Eastern Europeans altogether to forestall that concern, i.e. whether it's a financial number, 5%, or to increase some sort of military capacity to make it the calculation for Moscow to be, well, it's pointless to go in and do this. What should they do to provide their own security?
Well, I think they should, figure out what they need to defend themselves without the United States and work to that. That means deciding on a scenario. What's the threat? Is it an invasion of the Baltics? Is it a cyber attack? Is it a maritime threat from the Baltic Sea? And build the capabilities that are needed to defend that specific threat. And I think that defensive capabilities can go a long way, especially in the Baltic states and in Poland. Those countries are very difficult to defend, but not impossible. And so there they'd want to basically turn themselves into a hedgehog or a porcupine and make it extremely difficult and costly for Russia to advance across any sort of territory. But these are things that are within their reach and within the broader European reach. They don't need the United States serving this role. And there's this idea in Europe that only the American flag deters. They even said to me, we don't really care if you kind of draw down your forces as long as like your flag stays. That's what matters. But that's silly. Like, the reason that exists is because the United States has built up its military and has a reputation. Europe can get that. It just has to build up its military.
Yeah, that flag is only a representation. And if the representation, the reality behind it isn't there, then the flag is not going to stop a bullet that a defense wouldn't. I want to look at a slightly different aspect of this in the remainder of the time we have here, and that is on our relationship with Europe and how Europe sees the world, and we'll see if these things are congruent or incongruent. One of the interesting things here is, and I'm going to play a clip here that was captured kind of not off camera, actually, it was quite on camera, but it was not supposed to be recorded directly with Macron talking to some other European leaders. And really seeming to be unafraid of the fact that they see a camera that's on there. They make some pretty mocking comments about President Trump. Watch this.
You should make an apology to us. Because you didn't congratulate us for the peace deal that President Trump made between Albania and Israel.
I'm sorry for that.
Yeah. So, and he worked very hard. He worked very hard.
So if people couldn't understand there, he was basically mocking Trump when he at various times, like with Zelensky, condemned him for not saying thank you enough. And then here recently where Trump was supposed to say Armenian-Azerbaijan war, he solved and he said it was the Albania-Azerbaijan. And so they were kind of mocking here. That just seems a little odd that they would do that. But does that tell you anything about how President Trump is actually viewed by some in Europe?
Well, I mean, we've seen their public approach, which is, you know, obsequious flattery and worship. And you know, that works to sort of bribe Trump to stay in. But, you know, we know from, you know, reporting from his first term and between and under Biden that, you know, they get a laugh at Trump's expense as well. I mean, certainly, you know, this is not the first time the politicians have been caught in compromising situations and, like, you know, supposedly off camera remarks. But you would hope that they would learn that as public figures, they are always in the spotlight. Yeah. Always. There's always somebody listening and would keep those comments to themselves. Given the sensitivity and the fact that, you know, they are still dependent on U.S. security, it's not a good look.
It's not. Let's move on now to how the many of the Europeans see the threat from Russia. Now, I'm gonna show you, I alluded to these a minute ago. I'm gonna show you a couple of comments, one from Chancellor Merz and another from Donald Tusk. And I'd like your assessment of the real politics, because there's what's said in public and there's oftentimes what's actually meant. And I wonder if you can help us discern what is actually meant here. First of all, this is Merz saying that we're not in a state of peace with Russia.
Drone flights, espionage, the Tiergarten murder, massive threats to individual public figures, not only in Germany but also in many other European countries. Acts of sabotage on a daily basis. Attempts to paralyze data centers. Cyber attacks. I suspect that here in the room, probably every second person has already been affected by how their data networks and infrastructure have been attacked. We are not at war, but we are no longer at peace, and we must be clear about this if we want to meet the challenges we are now facing.
So he's talking about want to be clear. Now, he's referring to a lot of allegations that Russia has been doing, you know, sabotage kinds of operations or cyber attacks against many Western targets, as Russia might claim, in retaliation for what they have been doing for the last 3.5 years to kill Russian soldiers, etc. So I don't know how much that is or isn't true. But what do you think he means when he says we're not in a state of peace and we need to be clear about that for policies? What is clear and what should those policies be?
Well, I mean, there's a political motive here. Germany's trying to ramp up its defense spending. It's not super popular. Their economy is not doing great. There's a lot of controversy. I just came back from spending a week there, and there's a lot of controversy around the increased defense budget, whether or not they're actually going to be able to do it. There's also a lot of self-congratulatory, you know, patting on the back of how great they're doing and how they're leading the rearmament of Europe. But if you scratch below the surface, you find that, you know, there's things happening, but it's not clear that they're like adding up to much. And so I guess I see these remarks as sort of like a political tool to make sure that the money keeps flowing, to make people feel like there's a threat. You can't get people motivated about paying more taxes so that they can fund defense industries if they believe that there's no threat. So this idea that we're already at war, you know, trying to mobilize people. But, you know, I also, it's just kind of makes me laugh a little bit because, you know, if you really think you're at war, then wouldn't you be acting a lot more like urgently? Wouldn't you be building things up a lot more quickly? Wouldn't you be expanding your military much more than you are? You know, when we were at the one of my, you know, visits was to a military command college. And one of the comments that was made was, well, this isn't a place where we train warriors. It's a place where we train advisors. And I was like, what? Like,
wait, what?
No, that doesn't, that, to me, that does not scream like we are at war. That screams to me like, you know, we're still in the post-Cold War, like peace dividend world where it's nice to, you know, train leaders, but not train them as warriors. So I do think there's a disconnect between that rhetoric and then what you actually see happening on the ground.
And now let's shift over to Poland, a little bit closer to the Russian border now. And a lot of bad blood, a lot of bad history between the two. And he almost says if Merz was saying we're not at war, but we're not at peace, he seems to go a little bit further and says, no, this kind of is war.
With all these provocations from the Russians and Belarusians, for me, it means that today it's absolutely obvious that we have to stop all this kind of illusions. The first illusion was and is that there's no war. It's an, some of us, we like this definition, like full-scale aggression or incidents or provocation. No, it's war. A new type of war, very complex, but it's war.
Yeah, but is it war? Because I think what you just said is really applicable here. If the Poles think that they're at war with Russia, seems like they'd be doing more than just talking about it.
Well, the Poles are doing a lot. I mean, they have ramped up their defense spending a lot more than other countries. They have bought a ton of artillery and tanks and other types of heavy weapons and ammunition. They are building up their military force. I do think they are behaving as if there is a real threat. And probably will end up with one of the most powerful militaries in Europe when this is all said and done. And that's great for like Europe as a whole in some ways, except that Poland has never really been about like European defense. They're about Polish defense. So they have not always been good about like thinking about how, you know, what would Poland do if Estonia was attacked? Like, that's not the conversation. It's what would Poland do if Poland was attacked? So that's great for Poland. But it's not necessarily the solution for the rest of Europe. I'll also note that, you know, Poland is awfully excluded. You know, when the E3 meets, sometimes Poland is left out. And I think that's a mistake, too. I do think we should recognize that Poland is becoming a major defense center. At the same time, I do think that you saw with the drone incursions that, like, you know, there was a lot of tough talk, a lot of panic about these drones that were surveillance drones. To me, that doesn't scream like, you know, we're ready for a war if you're going to panic over 19 surveillance drones. So, again, there's a little bit of a disconnect, although I would put Poland and Germany in pretty different camps.
And that's on the kind of the pro-war camp. On the not only no, but hell no war camp is Slovakia and Hungary, led by Viktor Orban. And he, at this same conference, in the Copenhagen conference, was pretty clear about where he stands.
Who's the main threat against Europe right now?
Provocation.
No, it's a real question. Please, Prime Minister.
So the real danger, Europe, yeah. Economic stagnation and losing competitiveness. This is the danger.
Not Russia?
Sorry.
Not Russia?
No, we are stronger than... So, okay, guys. So we are stronger than Russia. Make some comparison and base your opinion on the facts. So we have more than 400 million people, yeah? Russia is 130-something. Look at the European GDP. It's like that. Russia is like that. We spend altogether 27 more on military spending than the Russians. So why we are afraid? We are stronger than they are. The question is whether we have...
I love you when you use my arguments.
Whether we have leadership to come together and to defend our interests together. Trump. That's what we should do anyway.
So he is not backing down because Tusk had some pretty comments, directed comments towards him, as did Zelensky, by the way, by name. But doesn't seem to be bothering Viktor Orban any. Does he have a point there that the real issues for France is not Russia, but it's economic? I said France, I meant Europe. It's economic and other kinds of stagnation.
I do agree. I mean, I don't think Russia is a big threat to Europe. I think Europe needs to spend a little bit more to build up some of its defense capabilities just so that it has enough military power to be geopolitically relevant. But yeah, economics is more important. Russia is not a big threat, especially now.
Now, I talked to Alexander Mercurius on our show, I think it was yesterday, and he argues that he is told behind the scenes that a number of European states actually agree more with Orban than they do with the Macron, Starmer, Tusk et al., but that they can't say anything out loud. Do you have, from your travels, do you have any idea about, is this just Slovakia and Hungary and this tiny little group and all the rest of the European states are like Tusk and Starmer, or how do you think that's divided actually?
No, I mean, I do think there's a wide variation of threat perceptions of Russia. They tend to be more concerned the closer you get to the border with Russia and less concerned the further away you get. But I think there's a wide variation of how concerned leaders are. I think, most leaders are saying publicly that they are concerned, partly to get the defense spending up, partly because, this is, you know, useful for making sure that Trump stays in the United States. If Russia's a threat, we can try to convince, you know, Trump to stay in to help with the Russian adversary. But I do think that for a lot of countries, Russia is not a big concern.
And I think that should be the case with the United States, for because no matter how you want to slice this and dice this, as you said in your foreign policy piece there, it is in no way, shape, or form an American interest in having any kind of a conflict at all with Russia. And I hope that continues to predominate, and hope they follow some of your advice. Before I let you go, though, I would like your comment on something that came out really odd from the administration here a couple of days ago. It kind of caught me by surprise, and that is that the United States President Trump basically just declared that assuring the security of the state of Qatar. And in this, he makes a really strange statement to my ears. The United States shall regard any armed attack on the territory, sovereignty, or critical infrastructure of the state of Qatar as a threat to the peace and security of the United States. We've been talking this whole time here about that we need to get disentangled from the European side and not get into potential where we get drawn into a war. And now here the White House seems to be saying, let's add someone else to the list. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of dismayed at this. The last thing the United States needs is to be extending more security guarantees to countries in the Middle East, given the current unsteady and unstable security situation in the region. I mean, a couple of caveats. You know, number one, I'm not sure you can extend a security guarantee by executive order. I'm not sure that's how it works. So I do think that this is a little bit flimsy. It's not like Article 5. The next president could easily discard it. President Trump could easily ignore it. Number two, you know, because we have 10,000 U.S. forces in Qatar already, sort of it's just a statement of the de facto situation that we're in, which is that if Qatar's attacked, it implicates the United States, and the United States will have to decide how to respond because we have so many forces there. So, you know, I'm not sure how much of it is a change in policy. But I do think that this, you know, stems a lot from the Israeli strike on Hamas negotiators in the country. Both the need to, you know, smooth things over with the Qataris, as well as, you know, send a little bit of a signal to Israel, like, don't do that again. You know, like, this is serious. This is a major partner of the United States. None of that, though, makes it really any better. This idea of constantly extending security guarantees to more and more countries is a huge problem for the United States and creates major risks of entanglement and future war. So, you know, I'm just hoping that this sort of fades away, like the Rio Treaty has faded away, in the sense that we still have these commitments and we ignore them, rather than becomes this sort of like ironclad thing like we have with NATO or Japan, things like that.
Well, certainly hope that's the case as well. Just a real quick bonus question, since we have a few minutes. How do you see the possibility for renewed war between Israel and Iran, or the U.S. involved with a war with Iran, or do you think that we can muddle along and have no more restarting that conflict?
Yeah, I think it's going to restart. I mean, I don't know when, but I don't see how the Israelis are satisfied with the outcome of the first round. It's pretty clear that Iran still has the ability to produce nuclear weapons, that any step back was pretty minor. They still have the intention to do so. They haven't returned to the negotiating table. So I guess I see the risk as pretty high. I'm hoping that it's not a near-term risk, that we're talking like at least a year or two before we have to, you know, replay the June scenario. But you just never know with Netanyahu, because a lot of this is motivated by his political future and his political goals. And for him, more war secures his political position. So overall, I guess I'm pretty pessimistic. You know, right now it seems calm, and I've been focusing a lot on Russia, Ukraine. So I'm just kind of trying to pretend that's.
You know, I interpreted the reason why the so-called 12-day war came to an end was because all three parties needed it. America needed it because we were giving away too much stuff, and we just couldn't get into an open-ended conflict where we just kept giving more and more of these precious missiles that we have, defense, air offense, et cetera. Israel needed it to end because they were taking lots of hits, that their Iron Dome and their integrated air defense systems couldn't block all of them out. A lot of them were being very painful. And Iran needed to be out of it because they were also taking lots of hit. But I don't see anything that's fundamentally changed from those dynamics.
Yeah. So a pause, maybe.
So if the thing got restarted, you would still have the same risk for Israel, if not even more so, because some argue that Iran has now continued to develop and build more, manufacture more of these missiles that can get through. So how could Israel restart it and not go back to suffering those same casualties?
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with you. I think that we're in the same situation. Like that, the problem with the first round of strikes was that it didn't fundamentally change the situation. So yes, I agree with you. We needed a timeout because missile stockpiles were running low. But the fundamental problem hasn't been resolved, and it won't be resolved militarily. Only resolved at the negotiating table. So, you know, I guess I'm pretty pessimistic on the whole Middle East portfolio.
Yeah, well, we can just hope that enough time passes where the cost just is recognized to be too high. And maybe people just finally say, okay, let's just have a deal that we can live with and let that be it. I hope that's the case. But yes, I know that's a thin hope. I agree. But it's
Friday afternoon, so we have to hang on to something.
We do. We got to have something. I agree with it. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. I know you got another overseas trip coming up this time, I think, to Ukraine. And we'd love to have you back on the backside of that and let us know what you've discovered there.
All right. Well, I'll be happy to report.
Cool. Look forward to it. Thank you very much. And we thank all you guys. Hope you have a great weekend. It's been a great week for the Daniel Davis Deep Dive here. We hit 250,000 subscribers. We attribute that to you guys and your loyalty and your faithfulness to share this with other people. I ask you to keep doing that. Really do thank you and look forward to seeing you with a bunch of new shows next week on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.